This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll bring you a conversation with co-hosts of the NPR Politics podcast about the road to 2020, both locally and nationally.
I would argue the entire path to victory for a Republican candidate and a Democratic candidate has fundamentally changed.
Plus, as Steamboat Springs is growing, we'll learn about tension over trails in the town.
And a look at a healthcare provider that's integrating mental health services into its care.
That's coming up.
It's Monday, September 23rd. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. 3 years ago, a class action lawsuit was filed against the city and county of Denver over their practice of removing personal property from people experiencing homelessness during sweeps of public places.
Today, the U.S. District Court of Colorado gave final approval of the class action settlement for that lawsuit. Jason Flores-Williams, the lead counsel on that case, joined us to describe what this means. He began by telling us about what's included in the settlement.
This was about equity and basically about what you would think of as an injunction saying, stop this behavior. And the behavior is, or was, hopefully, that police in the city of Denver were taking people's property and trashing it without due process. Before this settlement, let's say you had a woman, an older woman, who was going around with her shopping cart. And all of her worldly possessions, look, when you're homeless, you have to carry everything on your back. And so the police, usually DPD, would come up to her and say, you've got to go. And she says, well, I have everything that I have and I can't really move. Then they would take that shopping cart and trash it, or take somebody's backpack and trash it. Well, now the main thing, and this is unique for the United States now, this is why it's a landmark settlement, is that when the police or whomever on behalf of the city of Denver have an interaction with a houseless person, they tell them, maybe they say, you've got to move. You can't be blocking the sidewalk. Well, if that person has any property, now they have to give them informal notice, in writing, notice saying, if you don't take this property with you or move with it after 48 hours, we're going to take it. So it's 48 hours of notice, which completely changes the ballgame with regard to immediately taking their property and taking away and trashing it. So they can't do that anymore. And then also as part of that 48-hour notice, they've got to store it somewhere and provide that person information of where it's being stored so they can retrieve.
So what happens now that this has been approved? I mean, I imagine that law enforcement has been kind of conducting their business the way they have for a while. So is there an education component?
Well, yeah, I mean, so part of the settlement is that you've got to do some training. Is that they've got to now train DPD and whomever has interactions. There's like social agencies, interactions with the homeless in Denver. They've got to train them now about this settlement. It's basically a consent decree that says business like we were doing it before is no longer. We're not going to have business like that anymore. What we're going to have is due process, and we're going to treat these folks who happen to be experiencing homelessness with all of the rights available in the Constitution to the people who have millions of dollars, the people like me who are downtown living in nice apartments. So, yeah, there's going to be training, and this is going to be enforced.
What does this mean for other cities with laws like Denver's?
Well, it doesn't set precedent in the sense that legal precedent, like now this is federal court, so now we all have to do this. But it sets precedent figuratively in the way that other cities can now look at us. And I'm proud of this. You know, I like Denver. It's a cool town that, you know, that in doing this, it's not like I wanted to take Denver down or anything. I wanted to make it cooler. And that they'll be able to look at Denver and say, look at the way they solved their problem.
Jason Flores-Williams is the lead counsel on the case. Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Bye-bye.
We reached out to the Denver City Attorney's Office for comment. They wrote, quote, the court did indeed determine the settlement agreement is fair, reasonable, and appropriate. The court also commended the city for being so willing to offer more than the plaintiffs would have ever been able to receive through litigation, end quote. The office added that the settlement is not related to other ordinances, including the city's camping ban, which the city will still enforce.
And now for a look at today's headlines.
A public lands watchdog group is concerned about the location of the new Bureau of Land Management headquarters. The building in Grand Junction, Colorado, houses several businesses, including a corporate office for Chevron, the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, as well as a company that does natural gas exploration. That's concerning to Jason O'Neill with the nonprofit group The Western Values Project. He says it's problematic that the agency tasked with protecting public lands for balanced use will be rubbing elbows with oil and gas executives. A BLM spokesperson said in a statement that their process to procure the lease was, quote, open, competitive, and fair.
Three northern Colorado towns are set to receive millions of dollars in federal funds to upgrade their water infrastructure. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced a round of federal grants and loans to Estes Park, Wiggins, and Pete's, which is on the state's eastern plains. Estes Park will receive $1.3 million to replace water lines along Big Thompson Avenue. Pete's is also receiving $1.3 million to construct a new wastewater pond for sewage treatment. The town's current wastewater treatment does not comply with state guidelines. Wiggins will get nearly $10 million in grants and loans to fund major wastewater treatment improvements. Its current system is also violating health and sanitary standards.
The Federal Aviation Administration has awarded five Colorado airports $7.6 million in infrastructure grants. Denver International is among the airports receiving the grants. DIA is getting $1.3 million to reduce aircraft emissions.
E-scooters will soon be hitting the streets in Fort Collins. The Coloradoan reports the one-year pilot program is expected to launch October 14th. Scooters will be available in the downtown area and on CSU's campus. The city has contracted with an unnamed company to scatter 250 electric scooters throughout those areas. Colorado is growing, and that's leading to all kinds of tension across our state, not just in the major cities that make up the Front Range. Here at KUNC, we've been exploring growth and the tension that comes with it through our series Growing Pains.
This week, we're going to Steamboat Springs to see how that city is meeting the challenge. We'll look at the climbing number of 911 calls in town.
Now, remember, if a third call had come in, now we don't have anybody available, and now we have to really start figuring out how we would call it.
The challenge of finding affordable housing.
It just feels hard to not be able to afford to live in the community where you work.
And how, as the population of the town increases, its history may be getting lost.
My favorite quote is, "In the end, our society will be defined not by what we create, but by what we refuse to destroy."
We'll hear those stories tomorrow through Thursday.
Today, we're going to bring you a piece from KUNC's Luke Runyon. He begins our series with the story of a trail proposal that has exposed deep divides within the city's recreational community.
Yeah! Lorraine Martin and Barb Dowski steer their bikes over a small boulder on Emerald Mountain. It's a popular mountain biking spot overlooking Steamboat Springs.
I don't have my bell on here. I fell so hard that I snapped my bell off.
Did you really?
Yeah.
The trail is dusty and full of rocks. When we pull off for a break, two other bikers haul up the hill and pass us. Both women are avid bikers and in leadership roles at Route County Riders, a nonprofit that represents mountain bikers in the area. For the past year, their group has been at the center of heated discussions about the future of recreation here.
When you talk to people around other communities about the situation in Steamboat, every community is having a similar situation.
The situation Dowski is talking about is the Mad Rabbit Trails Project. In its original form, it proposed using city tax dollars collected from tourists to build a network of trails in two areas of Route National Forest, Mad Creek and Rabbit Ears Pass, hence the name Mad Rabbit.
Summer is on the rise, so we do need somewhere to put all those hikers, bikers, riders, folks who want to use the trail systems.
Martin's group includes some of the project's most vocal proponents, who argue that existing trails are overflowing. And without new ones, Steamboat Springs will be unprepared for the ever-growing number of tourists who come here.
It's not just that Steamboat needs new trails. Steamboat needs a diversity of trails for different levels of rider and user, and it also needs a diversity of trail areas.
The Mad Rabbit proposal comes on the heels of another newly built trail system. That one, in the Buffalo Pass area northeast of town, quickly saw jam-packed parking lots. When the idea of building even more came up, local resistance began to grow.
People started noticing that, in particular, elk weren't around those trails anymore.
That's Larry Desjardins. He's board president of Keep Route Wild, a wildlife advocacy group formed specifically to oppose the Mad Rabbit trails.
And it brought up concerns, and because of that, with this proposal, we started digging deeper and deeper on that and wanting to have it either canceled or modified in a wildlife-friendly way.
Desjardins says he wants an admission from the city's recreators that simply enjoying nature through hiking or biking has an impact. But he also says the addition of new trails hit on a deeper anxiety about how Steamboat is changing from a once sleepy ranch hamlet to winter sports mecca to now a bustling year-round recreation destination.
These mountain communities are growing, and people are concerned that if the growth isn't managed, they aren't going to be able to keep the same kind of lifestyle that they're used to.
With emotions running high, Mad Rabbit meetings and online forums became vitriolic. At one point, the local newspaper, the Steamboat Pilot and Today, had a backlog of dueling letters to the editor. And more recently, stickers have popped up on downtown light posts poking fun at Desjardins' group. They read, "Keep Route Entitled."
The population growth in the state has absolutely been acknowledged.
Winnie Della Quadri works for the city and oversees the funds used to pay for new trail initiatives.
Because a lot of people come saying, "I really like what we have today and I don't want us to change anything." Even if you don't want to change anything, it's all going to change anyway.
She says the community is taking steps to better plan for growth and how its recreation economy handles more hikers, bikers, hunters, and skiers. After bringing in an outside mediator, the parties involved in Mad Rabbit have reformed as an ad hoc group that can look at broader recreation issues as they arise.
You're going to be seeing this more and more.
Again, Keep Route Wild's Larry Desjardins.
And the sooner that we can come and say, yes, there's impacts, and yes, there's ways of minimizing those impacts, the sooner we're going to be able to have a plan for an environment that meets everybody's needs.
The original Mad Rabbit proposal has been scaled back to include fewer new trails and seasonal closures of some trails to balance the needs of wildlife. Still has to go through a federal environmental review that could start as early as March. Lorraine Martin of Route County Riders says her group gave up a lot of trail mileage to get closer to a community consensus.
There are more individuals who want to be getting out there on foot, on bikes. And I maintain that the folks that can get out there and be educated and be advocates for our forested areas, those are the people that we want out there.
Because it's a lot harder to care about a place, she says, if you never get to enjoy it. Luke Runyon, KUNC, Steamboat Springs.
Tomorrow, we'll examine how the sales tax-only revenue model in Steamboat Springs is causing problems with town services and the current plan to fix it.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
Boulder Community Health, a health system with 11 clinics in and around Boulder, has changed the way they provide care to patients by integrating mental health services into their clinics.
Here to tell us more about what this means for the healthcare provider and their patients is Jennifer Brown, a writer for the Colorado Sun. Jennifer, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little more about what it means for patients that Boulder Community Health has absorbed mental health care in its practice.
I would like to start by mentioning, you know, this all kind of goes back to the fact that we're supposed to have mental health parity in healthcare. That's been a federal law since 2008, actually. And the law says that people should be able to have the same access to mental health care as physical health care and that they shouldn't have to pay more. But in reality, I mean, I think anyone you ask would tell you that doesn't really happen. And one thing I had reported on a while back is that in Colorado, insurance companies pay mental health doctors 30% less than they pay other medical doctors. And consumers in this state pay for out-of-pocket mental health care 7 times more often than they do for other medical care. So when a full health system, Boulder Community Health with 11 primary care clinics, really has integrated mental health care into practice, it's a big deal.
You kind of mentioned finances there. How will it work for patients and for the business side of things?
Boulder Community Health has been doing this for a few years now. They did it through some federal grant money and state grant money that was specifically intended to get primary care practices to integrate mental health care. So what they do is they have 10 behavioral health specialists who work in these family medicine clinics. And it's as simple as, you know, they call it a warm handoff from the doctor on one side of the building who thinks that the patient might benefit from some mental health therapy to one of their behavioral health specialists. And the patient pays nothing extra for that. The patient goes there, pays a copay, and in return they get full health care, like a whole health for their whole body, mind and otherwise.
I'm curious if you think this is something that could be used as a model in other places outside of Boulder. Do you know of any other healthcare providers who are at least entertaining the idea?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of other examples around the state. And what's really interesting and kind of unique about what's happening at Boulder Community Health is that they're actually getting some buy-in from insurance, which is always one of the difficult parts of providing these services. And right now, they've started a second program there where they have a psychiatrist consultant. So doctors at the family health clinics will be perhaps prescribing medicine for depression or anxiety. And these patients are also seeing their behavioral health specialist. But they also have this consultant who comes in and reviews what's going on for each of these patients to make sure they're getting the right medications and the right therapy. And Cigna, for one, is piloting a program where they will actually pay for that service for their patients. Medicare will also pay for it. So they're hoping that, you know, and Boulder is one of eight places in the country right now where Cigna is piloting this idea of paying for that kind of service. And they're hoping that this will expand all over the nation. So it could have big implications.
Jennifer Brown is a writer for the Colorado Sun. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
On Friday, NPR Politics hosted a live taping in Boulder called The Road to 2020. And while the team was in Colorado, we didn't want to pass on the chance to talk to him.
That's right. Today, we are excited to bring you a conversation that's a little different than usual. We're talking with Tamara Keith and Asma Khalid from NPR Politics about the 2020 presidential race and what they're watching in Colorado politics. We begin by hearing from Asma Khalid about the format of the NPR Politics podcast.
It's a remarkably more casual format. And, you know, we sort of joke and say that it's akin to like me going up to Tam's desk and telling her like, oh my God, this just happened. I saw this story.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. But that is really fundamentally accurate, I would say. Like we pop into a studio and it is essentially as if the listeners are kind of a fly on the wall as we're talking through story ideas, talking through issues that have happened. It's a really casual format. But to me, I think more than even the format, what I have loved about the podcast is so often I will go out to cover events and I am stopped particularly by young people who say, I love the podcast. I listen to the podcast all the time. I feel really honored about that. I mean, I think that that's an amazing, amazing responsibility that we have.
I know you've been following the Colorado Senate race for Cory Gardner's seat. What stands out to you about this race?
Well, this is probably the hottest Senate race in the country in this cycle. This is the one that Democrats want the most and where they feel like they have a really good shot. And obviously, Republicans and Cory Gardner think that they have a path, but certainly this is... You know, he won in 2014, which was a really terrible year for Democrats. It was a midterm year in the Obama administration. Most of the Democrats who were facing tough races that year lost. And Cory Gardner was one of the candidates who won. And so now, 6 years later, it is a different year. It's not a midterm. It's a presidential year. And the dynamics are very different than they were when he and a lot of these other candidates were first elected. A lot of these other senators were first elected.
And Democrats really do feel like they have an advantage in the fact that John Hickenlooper, who was running for president, has decided he's no longer running for president and is actually now going to be contesting the Senate race here. I mean, this is something that, not to sort of broaden too much out into presidential politics, but there are other candidates who have been receiving pressure to do the same, saying that, look, you know, for Democrats nationally, there are wins to be gained in the Senate. And this is a state in particular where, to Tam's point, I mean, Democrats feel like they have a good shot, but they also think it is a crucial state for them if they have any hopes of taking back the Senate and to vote more for the Democratic Party.
What are you going to be watching for in the Colorado Senate race?
John Hickenlooper is really seen as the front runner. He has a lot of name recognition in the state. And by him entering the race, to me, it did sort of change the dynamic of what many folks had maybe seen to be as a potentially more open seat on the Democratic side. I think one of the interesting questions always when there's somebody who's deemed to be a front runner is just really how resilient they are. And that's a question in the presidential election I've been really looking at when we have a sort of clear front runner there at that point, is just sort of how resilient they are, because it does become very difficult when name ID for the front runner is so high for some of the lesser known candidates to just even build enough name ID that they start tracking higher in the polls.
And with Gardner, I guess what I'm watching for is, are there any moments where he separates himself from President Trump or not? He ran initially as this sort of, I'm going to be a moderate. I'm going to go to Washington. I'm going to work with Democrats. We're going to get things done. He has, you know, his campaign would tout his bipartisan voting record. Democrats would say, oh, no, it's not bipartisan. He votes with Trump all the time. Is there a path for a Republican who puts themselves at like arm's distance from President Trump? Is there a path for a Republican in a purple state? I don't know.
It does seem like it's changing. I'm curious if you see this in other states. Like, are you seeing shifts in other states?
Oh,
like
very
this?
Much mm-hmm. so. The map, I think, is totally changing. I mean, I think that's one of the most exciting things about having covered, you know, the 2016 cycle to now, is that I would argue the entire path to victory for a Republican candidate and a Democratic candidate has fundamentally changed. I mean, for a long time, Democrats would talk about a blue wall in the Midwest, and that would be your traditional, quote unquote, Rust Belt states.
Yep.
Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and even to some degree Ohio, that I would say Ohio had been trending more and more Republican. Those states are states that Donald Trump won in 2016, and the Democrats do see that, you know, they need to make inroads in, but Donald Trump also sees those states as being increasingly tilting more in his favor than, say, Republican 20 years ago would have. On the flip side, you know, there are states all around the Sun Belt, North Carolina, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada,
Florida-ish,
right? These are states that are demographically trending more towards the Democratic Party. And what I mean by that is you have a larger percentage of non-white voters in those states, and you also have a larger percentage of white college-educated voters. And those two groups in particular have seemed to be tilting further away from President Trump.
There's a lot of coverage, it feels like. Do you have advice for how people can kind of best sort through this deluge of information?
We drink from the fire hose, so you don't have to. I think that politics has in some ways replaced sports and hobbies and like things that are good for you. And it has replaced, you know, the releases and the relaxation, and people are so into it and so wound up that I worry about people. Like, it is our job to be obsessed with politics. Mm-hmm. Other people have jobs and families. And part of me says, like, you know, take a sip. Don't drink from the, you don't have to drink from the fire hose. Take sips, listen to the NPR Politics podcast, you know, read when you feel like reading. Don't go into the social media vortex. Just, you know, go to your favorite news organization website or go to your favorite newspaper and read the news once a day, twice a day, not all day.
How do you step away?
I run until I am tired.
I had a baby recently, and I think that that helps put a lot of things in perspective, I will say. It makes me realize also why I want to cover politics. And I know that sounds sort of grandiose, but look, the country and our politics right now has developed an extremely like racialized edge. And my kid is a little brown boy growing up in this country. And I think that there is like an element of that that has made me feel like this job is very important. But also at the end of the day, when I step home, I go hours sometimes. I hope my editor doesn't mind, but I go hours sometimes without checking my phone until I put him to bed and we have some time for ourselves.
That was Asma Khalid and Tamara Keith. Tamara Keith is a White House correspondent for NPR. Asma Khalid is a political correspondent covering the 2020 presidential campaign for NPR.
They are both co-hosts of the NPR Politics podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're interested in hearing more of our conversation, go to our homepage, KUNC.org, to listen to an extended version of that conversation. And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll learn about what state lawmakers are doing about school safety. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.